I wanted to give Gwyneth, who's one of our visitors today, who's come from a little bit of a distance, a chance to speak to the committee for 2 or 3 minutes, if she wishes. If not, we'll start with Lizbeth from Legislative Revenue. And I don't see Liz. Is Lizbeth?
She's right there.
You're here. But Gwyneth, if you would like to take a moment or two, the committee would certainly appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you.
You bet. Tara, can you?
Yes. You, back the other direction, Gwyneth.
Here. I can sing loud. I don't need a mic.
We noticed, Gwyneth.
I don't need to sit. Sorry.
You don't want to sit?
No, I don't want to sit.
Okay, the mic's right here.
Thank you.
Gwyneth, thank you for taking time out of your schedule to join us this afternoon.
I'll be taking lots of time out of my schedule. Thank you. And I don't know who any of you are. You all look like blank walls to me. So I'm just assuming that you're all senators and House representatives. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
You have
3 minutes.
You have 3 minutes, and you have five state senators from Eugene and from John Day and from Portland and Beaverton with you.
Thank you.
And your name for the record, just before.
My name is Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon. And I'm here with Support Oregon Services Alliance. And it's even more important that we're here today since Measure 28 has failed. Now the responsibility is back in your hands to raise the revenues that must be raised to preserve our right to life and choice, to prevent budgetary terrorism, because that's what this is. It's state-sanctioned terrorism. And none of you, I'm sure, want to be responsible for death, for people dying. And it is in your hands. You have the ability to raise revenues. And I understand that there's all kinds of political games that are being played behind the scenes and in front of the scenes. And all of that is your game. And we don't care. We want these services funded. However you do it, fund these services. We're here to support you. We know it's a tough decision. We know you have a lot of people that are saying, no, 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 no. But the taxes are lower now than they were in the 80s. We had a recession much deeper then than we have now. There is no excuse. There is no excuse not to fund human services, education, and public safety. If you think that we're all going to just go away and people can hang out in their gated communities and their private ranches and their wherever they are, I heard you guys, and I'm really glad to hear that you're not making 90 grand like our county commissioners are. You're all poor like us, so surely you know. How many of you guys have disability insurance? Probably not too many. And I'll tell you, if it happens to you, you'll be really grateful for these services. You know as well as I do it's bad for the economy to have this happen. You've got to have the political will. These flowers represent our compassion for the role you guys hold. You guys have a huge job. And we really respect and appreciate it and expect you to do it. You have responsibility. You have two choices. You can take the path of righteousness and make sure that the society lives up to its ideals, lives up to its values. We have the right. We're a free people. And we have also that responsibility to take care of our most vulnerable citizens. The other rose here represents the other path, the other choice. You don't want any more blood on your hands than is already there. Fund services. Find a way. We're here to support you to do that. And we are going to be here to support you to do that until it's done. Later on today, we're going to be asking people to sign a declaration, a proclamation. And we'll have that available. And we hope that you will find it agreeable. So thank you.
Gwyneth, thank you very much. Lizbeth is up next from Legislative Revenue to give us committee a brief update on the results from yesterday evening. Would like to thank our guests for joining us. Oh, thank you.
See you later.
Thanks, Gwyneth.
Thank you.
Chairman Deckard, and committee members. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So I just wanted to give you a brief overview of the unofficial count from Measure 28. And you have a sheet here, one-page summary of various counties and their, as they've reported, their unofficial vote count. So statewide, it was 54% no, 46% yes, with a difference of 100,263. And as far as the turnout, there's not an official percentage turnout yet, but from just the counties that I have reported here, the 17 county totals, you can estimate there would be at least a 62% turnout statewide. And to kind of give you a breakdown then of some of these major counties, you can see that there are basically four counties that passed it with more yeses than noes statewide. That was Benton County, Lane County, Multnomah County, and Polk County. But the big difference was just in Multnomah County, the percent of yes votes was only 57%, where usually in order to win a statewide vote, these Multnomah County and Lane County and some of the other metro counties really need to have higher than a 57%, and all of these were kind of in the low 50s, where Benton County was 58%, mm-hmm. but Benton's quite a bit smaller than Multnomah. Yeah. And then when you look at the other counties that voted in favor, voted against the measure, you can see that a lot of there were over six counties where the no percentage was 60% or greater. And that you can see the highest percentage defeat was in Deschutes County at 68%. And the highest turnout on a percentage basis was in Harney County at 77%. And just so you're clear, a few of these counties with pretty low percentage turnouts there, like Coos and Malheur and Tillamook, those are all percentage totals that were for the prior day of January 27, 2003. That's what the Secretary of State had reported up to that point. But the other percentage turnouts are all from the county's own websites, and they more accurately reflect the total turnout for the county. And with Coos County, you can see that percentage of no votes was 62%, but that was only 68% of those votes actually counted. So if there aren't any other questions on Measure 28, I just also wanted to draw your attention to this particular survey, and I've just kind of summarized this National Association of State Budget Officers survey of the states, and it was recently done in November of 2002, and it's for fiscal year 2003, and there's a whole report. I mean, it's like 63 pages, and it just goes through and dissects a variety of different issues with the state fiscal budget shortfalls in a lot of different states, And so I can give you and email you those various reports if you'd like. But what you have in front of you today is just a summary of Table 7 of this report and Table A-11. And those tables summarize then the different revenue sources and what have changed in those different states' revenue sources. So it gives nothing else for you guys to think about what other states have done, and gives you a bit of a snapshot on some of the changes that have happened in 2003. So I'll just briefly go through some of those major changes. You've seen 24 states that have enacted tax and fee increases for fiscal year 2003. And for states with sales tax, we've seen that 17 states enacted a sales tax changes for fiscal year 2003, resulting in $1.4 billion net increase. And Tennessee had the largest net increase, and that was $655.7 million. And that was a 1% increase in their sales tax rate in Tennessee. There were also six states which enacted sales tax decreases resulting from expanding exemptions from the sales tax. And then in the personal income tax area, you saw 17 states which enacted changes in their personal income tax, resulting in $1 billion in net increase. And most of the change came from Massachusetts, which had quite a few changes with their personal income tax system. They decreased some of the personal exemptions. They also restored tax on capital gains, and they delayed a decrease in the personal income tax rate. Other states enacted personal income tax cuts, including Kansas, which increased their earned income tax credit. And New York also established tax relief for victims of terrorist attacks. And then in the corporate income tax area, you saw 15 different states enact net corporate income tax changes for a net increase of $1.2 billion. New Jersey had the biggest revisions in their corporate business tax, and they combined the increases in corporate business tax with some small decreases for a net increase of $811 million. Tennessee was another state which increased their corporate tax rate by 0.5%. Connecticut instituted a minimum tax on their limited liability corporations and partnerships and S corporations. And cigarettes and tobacco and alcohol tax were really the ones that changed the most in states. So the majority of the fiscal 2003 tax actions occurred in cigarette taxes. You saw 19 states which increased their cigarette tax by a net increase of $2.9 billion. Many of those states increased the tax per pack on cigarettes by more than 50 cents. And New York also increased its alcohol tax relating to licensing. Now, with the motor fuel taxes, we saw two states which increased those taxes. Connecticut raised the diesel tax, and Rhode Island raised the gasoline excise tax by 2 cents. So the other taxes and fees category just kind of encompasses a wide range of taxes. You've got your personal property taxes in there, motor vehicles, other types of licensing, and also regulation enforcement to promote environmental conservation and to generate revenues for health care. So states that have enacted a variety of changes to these other taxes include like gaming levies and raising surcharges on nursing homes and other health care facilities and taxing pharmacies. In addition, there are also 13 other states which raised fees, including the court filing fees, 911 services, driver's licenses, hunting and fishing licenses, and also licenses for a variety of land uses. But do recognize if you look through the table A-11, that gives you more details on these fees and which ones were increased. But recognize that those fees sometimes are different as far as where their source is. And so some of those fees are maybe local sources, and they aren't a state source. So just recognize that would be a change in policy with those kind of fees. So that's it.
Questions? Thank you,
Lisa. Mr. Chair, I might add that you'll notice some of the states, our neighbor states like California and Idaho, don't have any major changes, but they're considering proposals, and they both have fairly large budget deficits. So this is always in a state of flux, and as legislatures are meeting and we're looking at gaps in the upcoming fiscal year, we'll see more and more changes in all likelihood.
Paul, has California's governor, I think he did, he proposed a surcharge similar, is that correct, to what we just voted on, or somewhat similar, income tax surcharge?
Mr. Chair, my understanding he was proposing a sales tax increase would be a sales tax increase, and I know that they also are looking at a substantial increase in their cigarette tax, which could have some border effects for us.
Everyone likes a cigarette tax. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Can you bring up the dinner?
Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I was asked to speak with you about the withholding tables and our plans to get those out changed in the event that Measure 28 was passed, which it didn't. However, we are still sending out revised withholding tables that reflect the phase-in of the $5,000 federal tax subtraction limit. And as you might recall, the voters in November of 2000 increased that limit to $5,000, and in the third special session, the legislature decided to phase that increase in. So for tax year 2002, it's scheduled to be $32.50. We did send out withholding tables just about a year ago that reflected the $5,000 subtraction. So those will be going out, hopefully for employers to use with their March 1 payroll that reflect the $32.50. So we just wanted to let you know that's the situation with the withholding tables. And if you had any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are now going to switch gears, and committee members, you're going to be disappointed to hear we are not doing an orientation today.
Does that mean we can leave, Mr. Chair?
No, I think this will be interesting. We are going to hear from, I think first up, Mr. Nesbitt and Mr. Sheketoff, four differing perspectives on Oregon's revenue situation and possibilities that this committee would consider. Mr. Sheketoff and Mr. Nesbitt.
How long do we have? That limits on Sheketoff. I'm warning you right now.
If y'all could be aimed to be done by 2, that would be perfect.
You go first.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'm having distributed to you right now a document called Our Action Plan for Good Jobs and Better Government, which I'm using at a number of committees on a number of issues. And so I want to just call your attention to the portions of that memo which relate to the whole question of the fiscal crisis of our state and the fairness and adequacy or unfairness and inadequacy of our tax system. And some of you have heard some of this information presented in previous sessions, but if I could call your attention to page 2 of the memo. We do document again in some places with updated information the shift in tax burden from businesses to working families, and note that our overall level of taxation at the state and local level has declined in Oregon over the last 12 years, but that decline has not been even. In fact, we see that from data in the late 90s, working families are actually paying a higher percentage of their personal income in taxes, state and local taxes combined in Oregon, whereas businesses are paying significantly less. So we have seen an overall decline in tax burden in Oregon. That's been well documented as we've shifted down the list in tax burden of the 50 states, but the decline's been uneven. Working families have not seen a reduction in their tax burden as a percentage of their personal income. All of the tax reduction has occurred on the business side. And I would note that that's a factor which has to impact voter decisions on proposals like Measure 28. If a lot of working families are feeling that they're paying more or as much as they've ever paid and getting less in services, they're right. And we would urge you to look at that mix of taxes, that differential tax burden, when constructing other possible tax reform options. I note in my memo, and I've handed out to you an excerpt from the latest report from Washington State's Association of Washington Business and Research Council. They issue this book, I think, every couple of years. It's got a wealth of information, but most significantly, when you, on the back there, when you look at the assessment from their data in terms of tax burden in Oregon, we have the lowest business tax share of all 11 Western states. Businesses in Oregon pay a smaller share of total taxes than is the case in the other Western states, and also businesses pay a smaller share of taxes as a percent of gross state product than they do in any other state. So,
Senator, do you favor the business activity tax concept along the lines that Federley talked about last session?
Potentially. It all depends on whether you want to take a big bite or a small bite and whether you want to. I think maybe I can respond to some of that in my later testimony, and then you can come back and try and pin me down if you like, Senator.
Thank you.
So this is obviously, data from a business research group. I think it is further validation of what we've been saying about the shift in taxes, and warrants your consideration. And we also, and I'm sure Mr. Shektoff will talk more about this, have new data from the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy that says the burden of taxes on individuals and working families is itself not necessarily equal. We now have the lowest or poorest households, lowest quintile, paying 9.4% of their income in state and local taxes in Oregon compared to only 7.1% of the income for the richest households. I can direct your attention further into the document on page 12. Further, a note that most of the shift in tax burden has resulted from Measures 5 and Measures 50, which reduced the property tax, which is a major source of business contributions to the public sector and public services. And as we've substituted the income tax at the state level to make up for school funding, that has those two factors combined have driven the shift in tax burden. We also note that there have been a number of reductions in corporate income taxes, for instance, what you did in the single sales factor last session, only taking effect right now, and the fact that you chose to connect automatically to the federal tax code has been a net loser for Oregon, and in the most recent biennium, in the current biennium, the state's had to absorb a significant tax reduction because of the accelerated depreciation provision, something you never decided to do in Oregon, but you were forced to do because of the connection to the federal tax code. This
dollar amount that was, Tim, but total dollar figure.
It kept going down from estimates as high as $125 million. Perhaps Paul Warner staff can tell you. I think $90 million was the last number I saw. I don't know if even that has panned out.
So I recall it was more than that. I think the last we had was about $108.
Okay.
And, of course, the reason for that going down is that the corporate forecast kept coming down. So as we connected it to the liability, that lowered the impact.
Now, as we point out this effect of an increasing tax burden on individuals, the response we've heard in prior sessions has been, yes, but businesses don't pay taxes. People do, which is true only to an extent because business taxes are passed on differently to consumers, to workers, and to owners of capital, and to in-state owners of capital and out-of-state owners of capital. And so question, I think, was one of the motivating questions for the development of the Oregon Tax Incidence Model, which your staff now manages. And I was on the Oversight Committee when that was developed. And just some insights from that. One is, I believe, looking at what the Oregon Tax Incidence Model shows us, we export a less proportion of our taxes than most other states do because of the nature of our tax structure. And so we not only have a greater burden on individuals rather than businesses, but we have a greater burden in state rather than taxes exported out of state to out of state owners of capital. Another finding from that study, the best tax, if we can say there is a best tax, Chuck and I joke about that Monty Python line about the best tax is a tax on foreign nationals living abroad, but you don't get to do that. So the next best tax, if you look at the Oregon Tax Incidence Model, in terms of having the least negative impact on job creation and the least burden on workers, especially low-income workers, is the corporate income tax. Just look at the data in the Oregon Tax Incidence Model. That's the one, which leads us to keep coming back to the idea that, if anything, we should be raising the corporate income tax, which is only paid, by the way, on profits. So if there's a concern about an impact during a recession, if you're not profitable, you're not paying it. We have continued in our polling to see significant voter support for the idea that corporations should pay the same tax rates on their profits that workers pay on their wages. If you were to equalize the corporate income tax with the personal income tax rates now paid by working families, you would net in the next biennium, which is not a high point in terms of corporate profit and corporate tax receipts, you'd net about $230 million.
Senator Ringo.
I just want to understand what you just said. If we equalize the business taxes to the
to the 5, 7, and 9% that individuals pay instead of the 6.6 at the same income brackets, that's what you'd net.
Essentially 9%.
Right, essentially 9%. Right.
So, Tim, on that point, and I might be jumping ahead of you on this in your presentation, do you think, and I don't know if OTIM picks this up, do corporations make decisions based on, because if the corporate income tax is the, in your presentation, the best tax to raise, does an employer corporation make a decision to locate and expand an estate based on, do you believe taxes? They would tell you, yes, absolutely. Taxes
I
are part of the equation that they look at.
Senator, obviously it's part of the equation. It's one of many criteria. But I would think a business would look at total tax burden and how the structure of taxes in a state affects that particular business. My understanding of our recent history in Oregon is that the property tax was an obstacle to Intel's initial decision to locate and expand in Oregon, which is why we have the strategic investment program to address that problem. And so we don't object to the strategic investment program if it can be used in a targeted, specific way to guarantee we're getting good jobs in return for the tax subsidy. I don't think that you can make the same case for the corporate income tax, and I don't think it would represent such a barrier as the property tax did for that particular corporation. I would also point out, and I thank Mr. Shekhtov for this finding, that there was a December 13th Seattle Times article about the recent history of Amazon.com, a company which hasn't been profitable but has been expanding and chose to locate in Seattle, where there is a business activity tax, a B&O tax, gross receipts tax. As a result, they haven't been profitable, but they paid $4 million in Washington State. And had they chosen to locate in Oregon, they would have paid only the $25 a year minimum tax because they haven't been profitable. So they made a decision to pay more taxes in Washington State because they were locating in a community which happened to have a lot of experience, a lot of skilled individuals who are skilled in software development in particular, not only well-educated, but happen to be particularly well-suited to their company. So obviously those kinds of decisions, the availability of the skilled workforce, has a big impact on those kinds of decisions. I also want to point out to you that as you are going to report it on Saturday, there were interesting numbers in that tax expenditure report that was delivered at the same time as the budget, when the governor delivered the budget. We've been tracking this for some time now, and we note the tax expenditures are growing way out of proportion to the rest of the budget. 2 years ago, in the 99-01 biennium, based on that report, it could be said that the state and local governments were collecting 46 cents in taxes for every dollar levied, for every dollar of nominal taxes levied, the rest given away in tax breaks. Now, a lot of those are tax breaks you can't control, like you can't tax federal land. But nonetheless, only 46 cents out of the dollar. Come forward 2 years to the current biennium, and that report now tells you we're collecting only 42 cents of every dollar levied. A significant difference. If we had just maintained the same percentage of 46 cents on the dollar, you would have $1.5 billion more to work with at the state and local level. It's a combined number in the current biennium. So we would urge you to look carefully at the growth of tax expenditures and look critically at those which are needed and those which are not needed. You can't necessarily get all the detail you need in the pages of the tax expenditure report. For instance, you can't tell looking at the tax expenditures for mortgage interest deductions and for property tax deductions, how much is attributable to owner-occupied homes and how much is attributed to vacation homes, for instance, or second homes, which is a number I think is worth looking at. And then finally, with those comments about the contributions to the problem we now see of an inadequate tax system and an unfair tax system, we would still be cautious about recommending to you any kind of comprehensive tax reform package, because if that goes in the direction of a retail sales tax, you have real problems with maintaining a progressive tax system if that's done. But even more so, since a retail sales tax is not deductible on one's federal taxes, you have the problem of trying to substitute a tax which is not deductible at the federal level, and if then you're trying to adjust on the income tax side or the property tax side, you're probably going to have to spend about $1.03 for every dollar you try and replace that way, which is not an easy proposition when you get into the tens of millions of dollars, and much less hundreds of millions of dollars in a tax package. And I think the best advice I ever heard from somebody who was expert in this field, who testified here in prior sessions in the late 90s, who was with the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, is that when you attempt comprehensive tax reform, you create winners and losers. And the losers are always a lot more upset than the winners are grateful. And so that's when you run into these political problems of trying to sell a major package. We would also urge you to look skeptically at the continued advocacy for a sales tax. We heard that again at the Oregon Business Council's Economic Summit. I believe, looking at the experience of California and Washington right now, a sales tax is no more stable than our income tax. And doesn't necessarily add stability overall. Look at those two states' experiences. And that's in part because a big component of a properly constructed sales tax is business purchases. And although consumer spending has remained strong in our economy in the last couple of years, business spending is way down, and that's what's affecting the sales tax receipts in those other states. So it's not necessarily more stable. The only truly stable tax we have is the property tax. And so I would... We are quite skeptical of the argument for the three-legged stool as being more stable. We can walk and we can run just fine on two legs, and provided we pace ourselves with the two legs that we now have, a property tax and an income tax. And by pacing ourselves, I mean perhaps in the good times, setting aside some money in a rainy day fund reserve so we can spread out the volatility of the income tax. We believe we'll do better than trying to... both practically and politically come up with a new comprehensive package where there'll be winners and losers and arguably a no more stable tax system than we have now. So we note in our packet for you a couple of recommendations. One of somewhat of immediate concern is disconnecting from the federal tax code, at least prospectively. Let's not stay automatically connected to the decisions of an entity which is very willing to do deficit funding. I mean, willing to cut taxes and not cut services because they don't have to live with a balanced budget at the federal level. And so why would we then follow their lead and have to absorb revenue-losing changes in the tax code when we have to balance our budget and we have to pay the price and reduce services? Witness the accelerated depreciation, and what I now hear is that price tag of $108 million in this biennium and what that could do to save some of the services you're hearing concern about today. We also would urge consideration of equalizing corporate income taxes with personal income taxes, as I just described. Look carefully at tax breaks. You're going to get more requests this session for yet more tax breaks. And you should be looking carefully at the revenue we need now to maintain even the reduced level of services we end up with. And perhaps if you hear of a compelling case for a new tax break, you should be offsetting that with a repeal of a less compelling tax break or less efficient tax break. And finally, again, the more we look at the problem we face long term, the more we think that to add some stability and sufficiency to the revenues we need for services at the state and local level, we should look again at the property tax and look at the commercial and industrial property base in particular. I was pleased to see that when Eric Blackledge testified, I believe it was in front of your committee, he advocated a statewide property tax, something which we've concluded in our recommendations. It's something which would be more stable, would happen to provide a good base of support for schools statewide, and which, if it wasn't done just on commercial and industrial property as we proposed, could also be made more palatable to individual taxpayers and working families by incorporating a homestead exemption, some amount of exemption for the first $50,000 or $100,000 of your owner-occupied home, which then would help, I think, address the concern of impact on individuals least able to pay, but also restore some of that business tax effort and responsibility to our tax system. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Chuck, Tim took all of your time, so thank you for coming. And we
it's been a pleasure. How's everybody doing today? Give me a two-minute warning. How about that?
Okay.
Can I be the two-minute warning, Mr. Chair?
Please. You have that designation.
Thank you so much.
Chuck Shakatov, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I appreciate the invitation to be here. The Oregon Center for Public Policy uses research and analysis to advance policies and practices that improve the economic and social prospects of low and moderate income Oregonians, the majority of Oregonians. We're part of a national network of organizations that was created to work at the state level on fiscal issues from the perspective of low-income Americans. People think taxation is a... This is a quote from Sheldon Cohen, a former IRS commissioner. People think taxation is a terribly mundane subject. But what makes it fascinating is that taxation in reality is life. If you know the position a person takes on taxes, you can tell their whole philosophy. The tax code, once you get to know it, embodies all the essence of life: greed, politics, power, goodness, and charity. I would only make a friendly amendment to add that votes on tax issues, I think, also encompass greed, politics, power, goodness, and charity. Before going into our suggestions of where we think the committee ought to focus this session, I want to give a little bit of context. I think Oregon has, a lot of Oregonians have had sort of amnesia about the 1990s, the boom years, where we did great. They've also forgotten why we're in a revenue shortfall. It was because we were drunk on an inflated stock market and we refused to save for a late rainy day, which wasn't an odd context. People actually thought we had repealed the business cycle. Economists of all political stripes knew that wasn't so. In 1996, Bill Connerly, the president of the Cascade Policy Institute, chastised the governor for wanting to spend the kicker and the legislature for wanting to give it back as a tax code. He said, basically, business cycles happen. That's the economist bumper sticker. If we divide the time into fat years and lean years, 1996 is certainly a fat year. But fat years are not always followed by more fat years. Sooner or later, the dreaded lean years arrive. And he talked about as well how difficult it is to cut budgets during those lean years. And those of you who were in the last special session, all the special sessions, know that. Oregon's economy, I'm also troubled by all the talk that we have to open for business. We've never shut our doors for business. From 1988 through the 90s, we had a gross state product growth that was better than the national average. From 1995 to 2000, we had the fastest growth in gross state product. The 1990s economy created 385,000 jobs in Oregon, 2.8% annually, which was the 10th fastest. Our population grew by 20%, which was the 11th fastest, and during this slow recovery, recent articles show it's still growing. Workers finally in the late 1970s had gains. Average incomes went up, but median income didn't go up as much, and poverty did not get reduced. Poverty stayed about the same percent, and with the rise in population, we now have historic levels of poor in Oregon. It's defined by the federal poverty guidelines. Moreover, another example, actually states like Mississippi did a better job during the boom of the 90s at reducing poverty than Oregon. Over, from the late 70s to the late 90s, the percent of working families with children who are still poor doubled. In the late 70s, 5% of working families with children were poor. By the late 90s, it was 11%. I've distributed to the committee copies of our biennial report on the state of working Oregon. Our last one we called Boom, Bust, and Beyond. And it's filled with information about economic information from the perspective of workers, as well as information of important things for workers, such as what happened to health care insurance, pensions, and the like. You'll see in there the data I just quoted, as well as that one of the problems facing Oregon is we had income inequality grow. We had the fastest growth in income inequality except for Connecticut, which is the richest, one of the richest states in the country. If you look at table 310, you'll see the on page 38, you'll see the growth in income inequality. If you look at figure 3.8 on page 37, you'll see median income didn't change much, but the top 1% went through the roof over the course of the 1990s. Another report I've distributed to you is a report that's about a year old. New census data recently came out, and we're hoping to update this. And it's called Things Don't Look Different Here. We looked at the census data on taxes and spending. There was a few news articles that were didn't tell the whole story. And you'll see that when you adjust for federal dollars and the like, that Oregon is about average, and most importantly, things did not change. The taxes as a percent of personal income, which is how you measure fairness and can compare across states, stayed about the same. And that's why we called it Things Don't Look Different Here, a slogan playing on the state's slogan. The distributional effect of taxes, however, is a whole different story. Our taxes have become less progressive. As Tim mentioned, the Oregon tax incidence model in 2001 showed that the lowest income Oregonians have the highest overall tax burden. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy had done a report in 1996 of the taxes across the country called Who Pays, that previous to OTIM were distributing, that showed that. And they finally just this past January, earlier this month, updated that, and I've distributed that as well, this graph. And you'll see the sort of purplish color in the back is with the federal offset. And you'll see that the lowest income Oregonians, the lowest quintile, pays 9.4% of their income in taxes. And these are non-elderly shares of family income for non-elderly taxpayers. And the top 1% is 6.1%. We have a regressive tax system, especially once you take into consideration the federal tax offset that Tim mentioned when considering, you should consider when you think about sales taxes. So that's the context. There's been a few big winners from the economy of the 90s. A lot of people either didn't gain or lost if you were poor. And we think that tax policy should reflect that or recognize that before you make some decisions. Our suggestions are sort of follow three rules, which are do no harm, protect our revenues, and solve a longstanding and worsening problem, the problem of tax burden on low-income Oregonians. First, the legislature should say, we reserve the right to be wiser tomorrow. We're going to repeal the rolling reconnect. We had done it, if you talk to Dick Munn, and I would encourage you to call him in, he was flabbergasted when he heard the 1997 legislature did the automatic reconnect. After the legislature had done it back in, I think it was 71, done the constitutional amendment, and the voters approved it, they had the same problem we had with bonus depreciation. All of a sudden, tax revenue started going down, and they ended the automatic reconnect and went to the biennial, review it, connect to the prior December, make whatever changes Oregon thinks is appropriate. It changes. It takes power over our revenue system and gives it to Congress, and it makes no sense. And if Congress acts after you leave, sine die, you could be back for special sessions. And those of you who experienced it, I think the entire room panel today did, I don't think want to do that again. And we should take back authority. If you do it now, it only requires a simple majority because you're not raising anyone's taxes because Congress hasn't acted if you tied to the code as of December 31st, 2002. And should be the first order of business of this legislature. Should have been bill number one, take back control of our tax system. Second, do no harm. Congress repealed.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
Question for Mr. Warner. Reconnecting, disconnecting, is that revenue raising? Is that at the start of the House? Does that need 3/5?
Senator Ringo, we have actually been in discussions with council about that. As far as the revenue impact now, if we were to prospectively disconnect from future changes, we would show it as no revenue impact. However, council has advised me that they would be concerned about that originating on the Senate side. The issue for them becomes the intent. And what is the intent? If the intent is to raise revenue at some future time, relative to a federal change, then they voiced concerns. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Thank you.
The next issue is the inheritance tax. As you know, the 99 legislature did not connect to the inheritance tax, cannot have an automatic reconnect. Only the income tax can under our Constitution. The 99 legislature neglected to connect to the 1997 federal law changes, and there's been an administrative problem for the agency, and there's a bill that's been turned in to address that. During one of the fifth special session, that was addressed, but it was also repealed on a pretty fast timetable. That's a big revenue hit to Oregon. The inheritance tax is Oregon's best tax. 2% of deaths are taxed under it. It's the wealthiest people. It's the most progressive tax we have. Next Thursday, Bill Gates Sr. and Chuck Collins, authors of a new report, Wealth in Our Community, I believe is what it's called, and Wealth in Our Commonwealth, are going to be in Oregon. They're going to be talking at 10 a.m. at Portland State, and then again at 7 p.m., I believe, at the Unitarian Church in Portland, about their book, about why Oregon and other states need to preserve it and why the federal government needs to preserve the inheritance tax. I think you should fix the error and pick a exemption amount that you think is reasonable and set it, but do not go along with the phase out at the federal level. If Oregon's gets phased out and Congress ultimately continues the phase out, because Congress phases out in 2010, that brings it back in 2011. So 2010 is the time to die or tell your friends to die. If they don't do that and they just repeal it, then it would require a 3/5 vote. I mean, that's sort of why the rolling reconnect's a problem now, a bigger problem than it was in the 70s. That if you want to disconnect from something that's going to raise revenue, you need a 3/5 vote, where you only need a simple majority. The bill may have to start in the House, but you only need a simple majority until such time as Congress acts. The next on do no harm is discussion. There's been discussions, significant ones. I've given you a report on the issue of capital gains cuts. Capital gains cuts are unnecessary and unwise at the state level. They do not encourage investment of any sense. The benefits go to the people who had the benefits of the 1990s, the wealthiest Oregonians, and they will only harm our budget. They'll only just make a big hole in the budget and do nothing to have investments. Federal capital gains may have some impact, but state don't. I encourage you to read the report. Only 12% of venture capital funds are subject to capital gains tax. You know, if it was such a big thing for venture capital, I know it's of concern to the chair. California has a higher capital gains tax than Oregon. There's other reasons why investments happen. Next comes under the topic of fixing the problem that OTIM identified and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy has long identified, that the lowest income Oregonians have the highest tax burden. And the best way to do that is to expand and fix the Oregon earned income credit. It's of states that have earned income credits, ours is one of, if not the lowest, at 5%. It was made non-refundable. Because it's so low, the non-refundability doesn't affect very many people, but it should be increased. It's the best way to target tax relief to the working poor families with children. There's a limited program for childless adults, very poor working childless adults. But it's the best way to do targeted tax relief to working families. And you can calculate how high to raise it in order to raise the tax threshold above poverty, as it happens in a number of states. And the reason it has to be refundable is if it's not, the lowest income people, once it's raised, won't get the benefits of it. And it'll be sort of a false tax break. Well, one of the reasons that last session low-income advocates prioritized fixing the working family credit by making it refundable was because it was a bigger credit and people were losing out because it was non-refundable. The EIC is so small, the refundable doesn't matter as much at the 5%. The original bill that passed the Senate 30-0 and then passed it with only a few negative votes back in 97 was refundable. It was changed in the final negotiations at sine die, to get to sine die. It makes sense for a low-income credit to be refundable. Unlike the credits, other credits that have carry-forwards, low-income people don't have accountants that they can carry forward credits, and they don't have the increasing income to use the credits, the carry-forwards. The next is fixing Oregon's corporate minimum tax. In 2000, fully two-thirds of Oregon C corporations, 23,610, only paid Oregon's $10 minimum tax. Correct, Mr. Nesbitt. The minimum tax was set at $25 in 1929. The market crashed, and the benevolent 1931 legislature lowered it to $10, where it stayed ever since. I can assure you it costs more for the Department of Revenue to process claims today than it did in 1931. If the $25 figure was inflated, it would be around $260 or so today.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
What year was that, please?
1931 was established at 25. 1929 was established at 25.
I guess what I wanted was what year was it that two-thirds the C corporation?
Oh, 2000.
Okay, thank you.
Now all S corp. Okay, thank you for the 2-minute warning. All S corporations pay it, and it's essentially a filing fee. I think it should go up for them as well. And on a corporate minimum tax, and this gets to the question about business activity. I think we should study what New Jersey did. They actually did an alternative tax that I believe is based on business activity. And if that nets more money, that's what the companies have to pay. So I think we should at least increase the filing fee and look at some alternatives like the business activity tax. Last is corporate tax disclosure. We need to have it. You know, this gets The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy has shown that lots of large corporations on the national level don't pay taxes. It was reported how Enron from 1996 to 2000, the parent of Portland General Electric, received a net tax rebate of $381 million, $278 of which was for 2000 alone, while over the same period the company's profit before federal income taxes totaled $1.7 billion. It's related to why do we have so many companies only paying $10. We need to know who they are. We need to know which companies are, is it hurting Oregon-based companies or not? And the corporate tax disclosure, I think, would go a long way to informing better decisions by the legislature.
Chuck, which other states require disclosure?
I think Minnesota or Wisconsin has a minor disclosure law, and one of the states around either Arkansas or Oklahoma might have one, but no state has a full disclosure law. It did, however, pass by initiative in Massachusetts in the late 80s or early 90s, and then the Massachusetts legislature repealed it. A few companies filed because the repeal date was a few days after the filing date for the reports, and a few companies felt obliged to file it, even though it was going to be repealed a few days later. But it hasn't happened on the state level. You have it on the national level. Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy is able to figure it out because of SEC filings and other regulatory filings. You can tell what they're paying in federal taxes. And we ought to know here in Oregon what they're paying.
I mean, just I guess the first question that comes to mind on that is, we have one company left, major Fortune 500 headquartered here. And how would that be competitively give us a competitive advantage to be really the one state in the nation that requires disclosure when 49 others, at least in part, don't?
Mr. Chairman, good question. I don't think it's going to affect corporate locations. You know, AOI did a study on corporate locations, and there's a whole bunch of decisions of why companies locate, and it's not that. And corporate location in and of itself ain't such a great thing necessarily. And actually, in Beaverton, if you read Business Journal last week or two, there was a company that moved from Connecticut to Beaverton. And what did they do? They got rid of four employees so they'd have the same number of employees in Beaverton. Yes, their headquarters is here, and now Beaverton can say we have the headquarters of this flat panel screen company, but so what? They laid off four people. So I guess
I just gently quibble with that because I'm familiar with that company, and their growth pattern and their growth plans from Connecticut versus Oregon is now Oregon will be advantaged in terms of how they grow. And as they add employees to their payroll, they're all going to be in Oregon rather than Connecticut. And that's one of the advantages that we have with them headquartering here.
Well, I guess it gets to the broader issue that was raised by Senator Ringo and Paul about taxes and what your business climate. Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury, at his confirmation hearing said, "I have never made an investment based on the tax code. If you're giving away money, I will take it. If you want to give me an inducement for something, I'm going to do it anyway. I will take it. But good business people do not do things because of inducements." Now, that's very different from the current nominee for Treasury Secretary, John Snow, who in CSX's latest annual report said, "We pursue all available opportunities to pay the lowest federal, state, and foreign taxes. We work through legislative processes for lower taxes." And in fact, his company paid nothing at all on federal income taxes of $934 billion over the past 4 years and got a rebate checks totaling $164 billion. Okay? We know that because of So here they pursue this, and it works because of federal disclosure, and I think we should be a leader in that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I don't really understand when you're talking about disclosure. I mean, the requirement would exist that these companies would pay corporate tax. Hopefully our state mechanism is sufficient to enforce it. So, I mean, tell me what disclosure does.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the legislation that's been previously submitted by then Representative Corcoran and Representative Rosenbaum has required a filing of a form with the Secretary of State's Corporations Division after tax reports have been filed and then amended ones showing profits and taxes of certain corporations, publicly traded, certain large ones based on gross sales. There were some blanks to decide those decisions. But it would be to allow us to know. You know, when you're sitting here discussing
to know what?
To know, are they paying just the $10? Are they paying lots of money in taxes? Are they using all the carry forwards that you'll read about in the tax expenditure report Why do we have carry forwards? Because a lot of them can't use the taxes. Now, sometimes carry forwards are important because of timing issues with corporate taxes, but 3, 5, and 7, 10-year carry forwards get beyond the whole question of timing.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Inga.
I mean, your goal is not to ensure that they comply with the law. Your goal is to know how their compliance might somehow still be unfair, or, and therefore we need to change laws.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, years ago when Jim Johnson was in Intel, they used to allow Mr. Warner, then economist, to publicly state how much in taxes Intel paid. They don't do that anymore. Okay. They just don't. You haven't heard a state official make that statement. Paul used to be allowed to say that when talking about the importance of high tech to the state. And when you're having negotiations about bills having to do with corporate tax breaks, and someone from the Revenue Department is here, they know whether or not Mr. Big or Ms. Big Business is right when they say, oh, this will put us out of business, it's awful. In their mind, they know whether or not this company's paying any taxes. Mm-hmm. You and I don't know that.
It would help us evaluate, say, whether a pollution control tax credit would really devastate a company or not.
It would help you evaluate Mr. Nesbitt's point about whether or not this is out-of-state corporations have advantages. One of the things the ITEP study does is it shows great variation within industries. They point to GE and Westinghouse, one paying a lot of taxes, one having rebates. I'm not so sure they're the same. They both make washers and nuclear power plants. But drug companies have wide variation. They're much more similar as far as a company goes. They have wide variation. So I don't know. Does Roth's market chain here, independent grocer here in the Valley, pay a disproportionate share of taxes compared to Albertsons, an Idaho company, or Safeway? I don't know. But you'd find that out from a tax disclosure report. And the releases in the 80s are really what led to the 1986 reforms that then-Senator Packwood did, which were good reforms on the corporate tax side. They've since been eroded, and I think the reports from ITEP back in 1999 showed that. But there were bigger changes in corporate taxes as a result of those disclosures that some very large corporations were paying less and getting rebates, billions of dollars of rebates, that the typical American couldn't get.
Thank you. Other questions, Paul?
Mr. Chair, I just clarify that we do have, we being the Legislative Revenue Office, has statutory authority to look at individual tax returns. We are under strict guidelines, though, about disclosure. We cannot reveal that information publicly. So, but you have given us that authority in the past to do that so that we can understand better the implications of a proposal.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I would just like to remind Mr. Shekhatov of a line by a friend of ours named Steve Novick that the rich have needs, too.
I have just one. Thank you, Senator Corcoran.
You're welcome.
One general question. And it was in both of the testimonies, was the 90s Oregon disproportionately did better than the rest of the nation, and also in that was that we had lower corporate income tax rates than most of the nation, and we provided a lot of incentives. The SIP program, one we worked on last session, e-commerce enterprise zones, which have already produced 1,000 jobs in Southern Oregon. And so to me, there's almost at least a disconnect for myself in terms of we had lower corporate income tax rates and embedded many incentives into our tax system, and being a state without a major research, world-class, though we're getting there. So we don't have that Amazon.com example in Seattle where the proximity to software workers are there. Is it not in Oregon's best interest then to have a tax structure that provides incentives for businesses to locate, headquarter, and stay here and expand here?
I both want to answer. I'll
go very first. Okay, I meant to put it to context. Oregon is 1% of the national economy. And I think we were on the tail, we were getting pulled along by a huge national boom. And we just cannot control the national economy. We are at the total whims of it. We're 1%. And I'm sorry, but I just don't believe you can point to good things that happened. It's certainly isolated good things, but to say that it was causation is just can't happen. We are totally at the whim of the national economy. Decisions in Washington, D.C., and California, another country, make much more impact than any decisions that this legislature could make as far as turning around a recession or creating a boom.
And Mr. Chair, I didn't say that we had the lowest corporate income tax rates. We don't. In fact, our rate is on the high end compared to other states. But when you total up all the taxes, state and local. That's where we see the low business tax burden and the low business tax share. And I would argue that with a lot of the experience we had in the 90s, particularly in high tech, and to give that example again with Intel, we managed to use targeted tax breaks, the strategic investment program, negotiating with these companies for specific deliverables in terms of good jobs. And those kinds of things make sense. It's when we do across-the-board tax cutting that we end up paying for things that are going to happen anyway given market forces. We end up giving away money without necessarily getting anything in return. And that's what we're cautioning you about.
Mr. Ringa.
The other type of business taxes you're talking about, like mostly the property taxes, I assume some sales tax.
Well, the property tax was and continues to be the major source of business contributions to funding public services. That's the tax that we cut throughout the 90s.
Right.
And that's the tax that was replaced for schools with an income tax paid 83% plus by individuals.
The reason why we have a relatively high corporate tax rate but low corporate tax burden is because we have no sales tax and low property tax.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's now 4 o'clock. Thank you.
Good job. We're on.
We learned how to tell time from Tom Bryan.
Next up, Mr. Wilson from NFIB and Mr. Schweinhart from AOI. Please come forward. If you guys are going to duplicate their testimony, we can.
Yeah. That won't happen. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, before I get started, God help us, as someone in Oregon should have an advantage over somebody else in the other 49 states. Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart from Associated Oregon Industries. AOI is Oregon's largest and oldest business association, and we represent over 22,000 businesses, and we're over 107 years old. We certainly appreciate this opportunity to be with you today. Before I start, I would like to take a moment to thank the legislature for their diligent efforts from last session. Work on such items as energy restructuring, the inheritance tax, and extension of unemployment benefits were greatly appreciated. Where is Oregon today? If you look in a recent Statesman Journal, you will have a pretty good idea. 122,000 jobs lost over the last 2 years. In those 2 years, we have seen a decline in business revenues, a decline in capital gains revenues, businesses' failings, layoffs by the thousands. We have seen more manufacturing going overseas, and the continued migration of capital gains profits moving to Vancouver. Getting away from Oregon's high capital gains, trying to get away from Oregon's high capital gains tax. We have also seen escalated frustration with businesses with business regulation and land use laws. Although you read about the U.S. economy slowly making its way out of the recession, Oregon still lags behind. We have the highest unemployment in the U.S. Or I guess today we were second highest. We're 0.4 below Alaska. We have the highest, one of the highest energy costs in the Northwest. Weyerhaeuser, one of the largest companies here, has taken a survey and found a PG&E has the highest rates of any of their company's locations right now. We have one of the highest minimum wages in the U.S. We have the second highest capital gains in the U.S. Is business hurting? Is Oregon's economy still in trouble? You bet they are. But we say this is 2003. Things are getting better. Let me read a few headlines that I've picked up since the first of the year, last few weeks. It says, loan losses, severance costs drag down Pacific Continental earnings. Lattice's fourth quarter loss, $127 million. Red ink flows at Pope and Talbot's. Losses mounting, Crown Pacific weighs its options. Sluggish market forces Oregon Steel to lay off 300 in Portland. Northwest businesses fight an uphill battle for recovery. Ratty Systems lays off 108. Recession leaving losses in its wake. Continued hemorrhage of manufacturing jobs threatens nation's economic leadership. Canadian furniture retailer closing 34 Northwest stores. Bank of Astoria's 2002 income down 17%. Kmart closing hundreds of stores. Airline executives think 2003 will be another deficit year. Portland area lost 2,800 jobs in December. Oregon gets mediocre scores in a development study. Just to name a few. We are still in serious economic times. It's about business and tax revenue it generates. The state budget is lacking private sector tax revenues and is faltering. Difficult decisions lay before you. Raising taxes is not the answer. We can no longer go on with business as usual. Oregon's climb back to the top of the economic mountain will not be easy. Steps must be taken now to ease the economic pain. Oregon must plan now for the improving economy in the short term as well as the long term. AOI has the following list of recommendations. State government must get its house in order. Reform PERS and the Oregon Health Plan. These plans should be affordable to employers. Taxpayers are looking for accountability. They want effective government, not more government. Streamline the development process and implement regulatory certainty for business. If Oregon is to grow and expand, we need help, your help in this area. Ensure a fair and reasonable rate process for customers before the PUC. No more four-week notice, 50% price increases. Continue to improve funding for schools. Pre-K through 12 budgets need to be constructed to meet student educational needs first, a basic premise for any school system. Decrease non-instructional expenditures. In the area of taxation, taxes are the most detrimental deterrent to business growth. It is also the top problem for our members, according to a recent survey. A few specific recommendations here are: capital gains must be reduced if business is to have growth capital and attract new business. Research and development tax credits must be increased. Oregon's credit is extremely low. If high-tech, biotech, and other technology-driven businesses are going to locate in Oregon, stay in Oregon, or expand in Oregon, we must have these changes. Pollution control tax credits have been working very successfully in keeping businesses in Oregon. They should be extended. Oregon also needs bridges and roads repairs. An increase in revenues is a must to meet this critical need. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, economic development is on the list of every state in the union trying to climb out of this recession. It gives you an indication of some of the issues we are facing. Businesses face tough survival issues from within every day, especially in downsizing or deciding which plant to close. If Oregon is to prove itself business-friendly, if it can demonstrate that government and business can work together to add jobs, promote economic development, then maybe those decisions will be made to close the plant in Georgia or Texas, not in Oregon. The legislature and the governor must put people back to work and restore consumer confidence. The Oregon economy needs help. I've said it once and I'll say it again. Remember, business is a horse that pulls the economic cart. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you have a difficult task ahead of you. AOI is ready to help when needed, and we appreciate your time and efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go to Mr. Wilson, then we'll open up for questions. Jay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB, currently with 12,000 members and change. Understand that the premise when we talk about tax issues, the premise that NFIB will always operate under is that state government will see significant increased revenues only when the vitality of the private sector is restored. And I think the salient question for the committee, we're going to pull our way out of the recession, as is every other state. So how are we going to look relative to other 49 states when we come out of this recession? How will we look relative to them as a place to do business, as a place to invest, as a place to grow a business? And I think that that is the most important question. And obviously, our state's revenue policy has some bearing on that. I agree with what Mr. Sheketoff said in this regard. Our Oregon economy is at the whim of some larger forces. There are a lot of larger forces at play that dictate how we do. But I think that there are some specific circumstances unique to Oregon that have put us in the spot where we are. And it's in my written testimony, but if you don't mind, I'll talk about it a little bit. First, with a tendency to put your eggs in one basket. which means if one sector of the economy does poorly, the small businesses that support that consequently do poorly, and it doesn't matter whether it's in natural resources or high tech, and you'll have a disproportionate impact on state budgets and other programs. Fundamentally, statewide for the past couple years, I can't tell you the magnitude of response that I've got that says that sales and revenues are stagnant within my member organization, and that cost of doing business has increased. And I list some of those increased costs, and not making a value judgment, but you ought to know what they are. That is, energy costs have skyrocketed in the last year significantly. Liability insurance premiums, which impacts some people's ability to even do business if you can't afford those. Increases in health insurance premiums, minimum wage increase, unemployment tax increase, and an increase in workers' comp premium assessment. And those are just a few. Now, with regard to my observations about the tax system, and I'll actually agree with Mr. Nesbitt on some of the observations he made, and that is reliance on income tax isn't necessarily a bad thing. We hear how we need to have more stability, how we need to have three legs. From our perspective, an income tax makes the most sense. First of all, it is based largely on an ability to pay. Second, it is applied as fairly as I can imagine a tax can be applied. For example, you know, if you were taking a look at a B&O tax, there would certainly be people who have a high payroll or high level of business activity to be taxed at low profit margins, and you'd bet you'd be hearing from them in that event. You kind of avoid those problems with an income tax. And third, and most importantly, I think it gives you a relatively accurate account of the economic well-being of the people you represent. You can have some good idea that the people you represent are hurting financially because it bears out with regard to tax revenues and the fact that you're not seeing any. Also, I guess I'd warn the committee against what I would term the elusive pursuit of tax stability. And that is, you know, Oregon is not unique with our budget problems. I think only two states in the entire United States are not wrestling with budget problems. One of them is Arkansas, and I forget what the other is. But the point is, they all have some various mix of taxes, whether it's income, sales, capital gains, payroll, gross receipts, and they're all wrestling with the same problem, which indicates to me that fluctuations in tax receipts are not unique to the income tax. It's just as pervasive with sales tax and any other tax, as I note with the possible exception of property tax. So I too would kind of look askance at any notions of a sales tax being the silver bullet, because I don't think that'll be the case. Small business priorities, and I list two. The first is capital gains reduction. Not only is it something that AOI supports, we support it too. You'll notice that I note what the Governor's Small Business Council's findings were. And I look at capital gains. If capital gains is a problem in California at 9 3/8 or 9.5, and Oregon's is 9%, our problem is Washington has zero. That is Oregon's problem. And when you talk about disparities and somebody can choose to invest or move across the river, that's where it comes into play in the state of Oregon. And that's why I think that you might be well served to look at that as a tax issue and see if you can attract more investment by virtue of narrowing the gap between Oregon and Washington. As a small business matter, and one that I really agree with the Governor's Council's findings, and that is, for a small business owner, their business is their primary asset. In other words, it is their retirement plan, and to pay 9% relative to 0% in Washington, there's just something a little outrageous about that. With regard to the estate tax, NFIB does not represent Bill Gates Sr. I have nobody like him in my organization, but I can tell you that if you want to keep family assets intact, I think as a policy discussion, you ought to look at exempting up to a certain level beyond what's currently exempted, or get rid of the estate tax in the state of Oregon altogether. When you look at what it does to small business, now people don't pose this as a small business issue, but I can tell you unequivocally that it is.
What limit would you put that at for the exemption on the estate? What level would you, to get most of your membership under the bar for estate tax?
Sure. Senator Deckert, Let me give you two answers. The official NFIB answer is get rid of it altogether. I feel very confident that, you know, I'll throw out the number 5 million. I feel very confident that if that kind of exemption would probably capture most, I mean, probably all NFIB members, just to be frank about it. When you talk about 70% of business owners don't businesses do not make it through the second generation, 90% don't make it through the third, 9 out of 10 successors whose family businesses failed within 3 years of the death of the original owner said difficulty paying the tax was a primary reason. You got 80% of business owners who are diverting assets, whether it's through insurance premiums or gifts of stock or other means, to avoid the tax. That is a diversion of assets that could be going to productive business use. It is a uniquely small business issue, and I hope to convey that upon you because it is characterized as for the rich. And let me tell you, I don't have them in NFIB. My typical member makes $35,000 to $40,000 a year. Their money is wrapped up in farm equipment, machinery, or in my case, you know, transmitters, translators, and smart caster systems for a radio station. That is where a small business owner is impacted in this issue. So in terms of two concrete policy issues, those are the two that I would forward to the committee. Thank you.
Yeah. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I have a couple questions. AOR published this 54 ways to help the state out of the jam. I can't remember the exact term of the document, but some of them really struck me as odd, and I just wanted to see if Mr. Schweinhart would respond. What do you consider the savings would be of eliminating ESDs with the exception of rural areas?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I don't have an answer for that right now. I'd have to look at it. Our president, Richard Buttrick, put that list together, and he has the answers to that. If you want to talk to him more than me, I have certainly not would not have an answer for everything on there for you. I may have an answer for some of them.
Okay. I'm just real curious how that would work, like in Lane ESD, when in fact you have 4J, which is the third largest school district in the state,
mm-hmm.
and Lane ESD provides services that the area around Eugene, which I don't know if you'd call that urban or not, certainly can't provide. Mr. Chair, another question. There's a big discrepancy between what you claim would be the savings in the state motor pool and what a study shows. Can you respond to that? You're talking about saving 10 to 15% by selling the current fleet, which has a value of $20 million?
Do I know the, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, do I know the discrepancies between them? No, I've not seen the report.
Might be good for you to look at LFO's response.
Yes, sir.
Another question, Mr. Chair, and I won't belabor this, but I just want to make the point that, you know, It's pretty tough when you have the business community coming out with a revenue-neutral sales tax, and then you have AOI coming out with all these charming cost-saving mechanisms, some of which have no application to the general fund at all. Contracting out management of prisons. Do you know where the prisoner cost of $45,000 a year came from?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corker, not offhand.
Okay. Legislative revenue estimates that, or legislative fiscal estimates, it's more in the neighborhood of $22,700. Okay. I mean, I guess my point's made, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cochran, I think some of those numbers there are based on a point in time, whereas things change over time since that was written. That's the only real response I can give you at this point.
Mr. Chair, are you familiar with any of the numbers around OLCC privatization?
No, I'm not, sir.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Stern. I just have one general question, and I guess it falls in the category of the conversation we had with the prior panel in terms of investing, and I guess Amazon.com might be a good jumping-off place, because if they looked at some of their relocation decisions or investment and expansion decisions, the prime motivator for them was highly educated, highly skilled workers. And I'm trying to weigh in terms of estate tax and the capital gains and other tax cuts that we might entertain in this committee. given the $2 billion shortfall we're in, how does Oregon make what I see from my vantage point, certainly in Washington County, the very necessary investments on retention of current business employees? And Nike, this is a huge issue. And then recruitment and investments in higher ed and education that I think are going to be so vital to our ability to compete in a knowledge-based economy. Either.
Mr. Chairman, what I would tell you on that is that it's not going to be easy. I mean, we're not in a situation right now where it would be easy. But if for the future that you want, if you want these things to work, like I said, you want tax revenues. You want increasing tax revenues. And what I've talked about is trying to do something to increase those revenues. But there are several ways to do that, and we talked about them. But I don't think our members have indicated that taxes are the leading motivator. Not to say there aren't others, and not to say it's the only thing they look at. But in order to get those people here, in order to keep them here, because they will go somewhere else. I mean, the climate is right for that to happen. I think we need to be a player in the global market. We need to be a player in the U.S. market. And in order to do that, it's going to invite some incentive somewhere to get that economy going. And we are not there now.
Mr. Chair. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question as it relates to investment recruitment into Oregon. You know, we've got OECD and the various economic development partners around the state have a variety of pretty general investment recruitment tools kind of in their toolbox, whether it's enterprise zones or e-commerce zones or the strategic investment program, workforce development dollars. It seemed to be pretty broad. A lot of folks from different business categories can access those. Do you, has AOI, maybe even NFIB for that matter, had any discussions about additional incentive tools and perhaps some more narrower targeted kinds of investment tools as we talk about a bioscience industry in the state or other investments, and perhaps even talking about the international side as we look to perhaps some additional international investment in the state as it relates to the new Lufthansa investment coming directly into the Port of Portland or the PDX.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, for AOI's part, yes, we have. We are having those discussions. We've talked, in fact, with the governor's people just the other day about overseas business overseas. We think one of the most important things that you discussed it was the workforce development. We think it's very important. But we also think that there is something like the corporate income tax or capital gains or other incentives that can come along with those that would help draw those people to the state. Research and development tax credits, we think, would be huge for trying to keep and entice other R&D companies here, because manufacturing is going overseas. And I know the governor wants to make an effort to keep it here, but short of that, it'll probably continue. And research and development is where Oregon's been and probably where it needs to be strong. And not forsake manufacturing, because obviously it's important too. If that answers.
Chair Decker, Senator Starr, our organization really isn't equipped to have those types of discussions.
Mr. Chair, an additional question. There's been a lot of talk about the state looking at distribution centers. You know, as it being a distribution hub, we've got, particularly in Portland, the combination of Marine, of two major rail companies coming together, highway system. We now have direct cargo service to Asia, and we've had it for quite a while to Europe. You know, to use some of those strategic alliances to create some kind of a distribution center, as the economic development model, as we move forward. Could you comment on that particularly? But in addition to that, have you had discussions about what we can do as a state, you know, here in the Capitol building about providing incentives, you know, for those kinds of investments, to recruit those kinds of investments, whether they're Oregon companies today or folks that see an opportunity here to use the Port of Portland as a distribution center?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, certainly we've talked about it. I haven't talked about it personally, but some of my colleagues have been talking about it, and we have been looking at it, and we do like the idea. And other than that, I say we're looking at it and would certainly, you know, take a positive look at trying to do something there. But yes, it would probably involve, I mean, that's going to involve quite a bit of coordinated efforts to get that type of site set up, but I mean, if we can bring jobs and economic development to the state, it would be certainly worthwhile.
And one last question, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. As it relates to industrial land supply, you know, I'm very familiar with a recent case that is in Washington County of a high-tech firm that wanted to locate here, or in Washington County in Oregon, had a certain requirement, a number of acres they needed to site the facility. They went looking for the land. It didn't exist, except that there was a lot of bare ground right outside the urban growth boundary that had all the various services, necessary services there, and yet there was no mechanism by which to, even in an emergency situation, have an urban growth boundary expansion to allow this company to site. This company wanted to grow its company, and has grown it, and instead of growing their company in Washington County in Oregon, where we would have several hundred very good paying jobs and potentially more as we move out of this recession, Colorado Springs is now the recipient of those great jobs. Has AOI had any discussion about a position as far as urban growth boundary expansion as it relates to industrial lands, not in the grand scheme of letting Metro basically run through a process where they expand the urban growth boundary for industrial lands, but in respect to kind of an emergency, economic emergency kind of situation where it allows some flexibility to expand urban growth boundaries when you've got investment that's ready, willing, and able to move, and you're in a recessionary environment. Would you care to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I think you hit a sore spot for many of our members who have talked about that. I know we have talked to the governor's staff about just such an issue, and I understand some of your colleagues are also working on the problem. We would certainly support something like that. We obviously think there's a shortage, and particularly in a situation you've talked about where you've got somebody that wants to locate here, provide great jobs, and is basically told to go away. You can't do it. And we think that's terrible. And we'd like to see some changes in it. And we'll certainly support them.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I do have one question for both of you, and that is, you know, given your lack of support for Measure 28 and the failure of Measure 28 yesterday, and given the fact that we're going into this budget cycle with approximately $1.7 billion hole, and given the fact that you want to reduce, I guess I'd like to know, first of all, what are the dollar signs, what are the figures on the capital gains cuts, the research and development tax credits, the pollution control tax credits, and the elimination of the estate tax? What does that all amount to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I don't have them here in front of me. It's not. I know we've been talking to Paul trying to get some of those, so we don't have all of them. I'm not going to tell you it's not a cheap amount, because it's obviously comes into the millions. But just honestly, our thinking is, in order to get this economy moving, you've got to do something to put people to work. You've got to get the consumer spending again, and we think that's the way to go. And I'm not saying it's going to be easy, and I'm not saying that there isn't some room flexibility there. But those avenues are the ones we see that you need to be moving toward.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm curious about how beneficial being on the front page of the New York Times with the shortest school year in the nation is for recruiting people.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, it's not an advantage. It's a terrible advantage, disadvantage. and we certainly don't want it to happen. But we certainly don't want to have the highest unemployment in the nation, and we certainly don't want to have the highest income taxes, and we certainly don't want to have the highest capital gains taxes in the nation also, because they're all detrimental.
With that, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, and I think that concludes our Senate Revenue Committee. Mr. Betzer, did you want to?
I might say a couple words.
Come on up. Oh, boy. Mr. Buttrick.
Gentlemen, Richard Buttrick, Associated Oregon Industries. Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, you raised a couple of questions. I don't know if I have absolutely specific answers to them, but I thought I'd take a minute and give you some numbers. You ask about education service districts. The latest number I have is about between $90 and $100 million per year, with Multnomah County getting approximately 25% of that money. And it was interesting, I just learned yesterday, actually, that Multnomah County Portland School Board doesn't feel that they need that much service from that ESD, and so that ESD actually gives money without service back to Portland school system. And the suggestion, which you read in part, Senator, was left out the part that if we did eliminate certain funding for ESDs, some of that money should go to the district superintendent of public instruction in that area, and then that individual could decide what services they wanted to use and hire what services they needed. It's not that ESDs don't provide a service. They take care of disadvantaged special students. But we're trying to get money back into the classroom and into the system. And we saw ESDs, with the exception of rural areas, which cover very large areas that probably don't have the capability of doing it like, say, Multnomah County or Marion County or Lane County would. So that was the point there. As far as the other point you raised was the motor pool. Motor pool, was that? That actually idea was not mine, but I did repeat it, and I've been repeating it now for about 6 years. It came from Senator Clarno. Right. The LFO report did quote a study. I forget which study they quoted, but they, I think, would agree that if you sold the motor pool, as I recall, the motor pool was roughly worth $20 billion, which would be $20 million. They also said that if it was privatized, it would cost more money, and that's a matter of debate. I don't believe it would.
Mr. Buttrick, actually, I think that privatization report came as a result of Senator Corno's request, and
okay.
And she has since not made a big issue of doing it, so I was surprised that it showed up. Are you familiar with what happened to the three sex abuse prisoners we sent to Texas, to the private Texas?
No, I'm not aware of the sex abuse prisoners.
Mr. Chair, they escaped, and the Department of Corrections in Texas wasn't informed until the day after they had escaped by the private company. So in addition to the question that your amount that you came up with is double what LFO anticipates, I think that's a problem. And then, while I got you here, Mr. Buttrick, I guess the other comment
that
I want to make...
Mr. Chairman, let me just respond to that. I think that LFO, parenthetically, leaves out the capital costs and deals just with the personnel, which in the report that I read, that came, I believe, from Oregon Taxpayers Research Organization, did include the total cost. Therefore, you're dealing sort of with apples and oranges there. There is a huge debate, and always has been. I was a parole officer myself for 10 years in one county system and one state system, and there's always been a debate as to, you know, safety, and is the state better, more secure at running something than the private sector? And when you do have a situation wherein you could send two kids to Harvard Law School for the price of keeping them in an institution, including the institution's cost per day, then something's wrong. Something's wrong with that. And the staffing pattern, if you look at it, is very high per prisoner. And so again, maybe it should be, maybe it shouldn't. The entire point of these 54 points was to make suggestions for people to think about. Let me raise one that is very controversial and completely politically incorrect, just for the sake of debate. I recommend eliminating the Women's Commission and the Black Commission and the Hispanic Commission. And the numbers that I recall on LFO were combining 550,000. Right. Is that correct?
Yep.
And here's my point on that. Okay, let's just say that one of them costs $100,000 as a round figure. And a first grader's school book, teaching them how to read, costs $20. So every $100,000, that's 5,000 first grading reading books. And so my question is to you, what would you rather have?
Mr. Chair, I guess the point I wanted to make is that a bunch of fine people from all around the state sent me your wonderful list. And, you know, in trying to deal with the crisis we're dealing with, and then, you know, what we're getting from the business community is give us more tax breaks so that we can dig a bigger hole. To get your 54 comments and have them, you know, eliminating the Covered Bridge Advisory Committee, which uses no general fund money.
Well, actually, it's been
eliminated. The Ginseng Advisory Committee, which has $1,900 and exists on licenses. Eliminating the body piercing licensing program, which has no general fund or lottery funds. You can kind of get the drift here of why eliminate state board and speed control, nothing to do with the general fund. Eliminate the Advisory Committee on Bicycles, nothing to do with the general fund. I guess you can kind of get my drift. If we're going to have a serious discussion in the state about how to recruit businesses, you know, we don't want to be laughed off the face of the earth trying to do it. And it was really tough for me to have to deal with, you know, this kind of stuff when we're in such dire straits. I guess that's the point I wanted to make to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I appreciate that. Again, those are on the tail end of the list, and the purpose of them was to have you think about what's important and to think about what boards and commissions may not need to exist. There are some that cost money. The more substantive hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars worth of suggestions have been embraced even by the governor recently, which we're very pleased to see. For example, PERS, changing the commission. Making a defined benefit plan for new employees. You may recall that when we, in 1995, I believe, in the session, we came in with a bill. We got killed. It didn't happen. But we did suggest a defined benefit program with an employee paying 6%, the state or the employer paying 6% for new employees, not touching a single current employee or past employee, and it failed. If it had passed 7 years ago, I don't think we'd be $15 billion going to 20 in debt now.
Senator Ringo, did you have one last
question? I've got a long question. Oh, okay. Thanks for coming, and I apologize. I wasn't here for most of the presentation and some of your exchange with Senator Corcoran. My problem with your 54 points is that I think it propagated the misconception that there's lots of easy, quick fixes that will raise lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one thing for you to say, this is something I want you to think about, and it's always good that we think and we analyze, but that's not what you did. You propagated a misconception that's very, very damaging. And the idea that we have lots of waste, and if we were really doing our job, we could easily take care of it. And that's why I think your article has done a great disservice to our state.
Well, it's done. Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's gotten an enormous response. I'll give you that. I think that probably the next thing I publish editorially, may have another 50 points on, coming from citizens from all over the state and our own members. The interesting thing about it to me is that it has been paid attention to, both by our legislative leaders and by the citizens of Oregon. And so far as what you consider to be frivolous, bad moves, there are billions of dollars of suggestions in there that should have been taken up years ago, and that's the truth.
Did you ever end?
Mr. Buttrick, thank you very much. I really appreciate
your welcome.
Time. Joe, JL, thank you. Chuck, thank you. And we are adjourned.